Coming up on this week's Book Show, journalist Jonathan Alter's new book, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life, is the first full-length biography of Jimmy Carter, the 39th President of the United States, a Nobel Prize-winning humanitarian. He tells the epic story of an enigmatic man of faith and his improbable journey from barefoot boy to global icon. Jonathan Alter on this week's Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Journalist Jonathan Alter's new book, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life, is the first full-length biography of Jimmy Carter, the 39th President of the United States, a Nobel Prize-winning humanitarian. Alter not only interviewed Carter more than a dozen times, he also interviewed 18 members of the Carter family, George H.W. Bush, Walter Mondale, Carter's top cabinet members, and over 250 people close to the president. He tells the epic story of an enigmatic man of faith and his improbable journey from barefoot boy to global icon. Alter shows Carter to be a flawed but underrated president of decency and vision who was committed to telling the truth to the American people. Jonathan Alter is an award-winning historian, columnist, and documentary filmmaker, as well as best-selling author. He is an MSNBC political analyst and a former senior editor at Newsweek. Again, the new book is His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Jonathan Alter to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you on the program. Did you know at the beginning of this project that this would, and I think we're all on the same page here, this is a sympathetic portrait of this man. You're making a case for him being a very good man and a very good president.
Yes, I am. But it is warts and all, I have to say.
Yes.
Whenever I came across something unflattering about Carter that I thought had any significance to the story or historical significance, I certainly didn't delete it. So I'm not making a case for him. This is not hagiography. I'm trying to present a balanced, historically accurate depiction of his contributions and of what he's like as a person. And it's, he's led an epic, almost novelistic American life. So I wanted to capture that. And I tell the story as a sort of a flowing narrative. But within that, I try to get at what I think is a proper reappraisal, revision of the, kind of lazy-minded consensus about him, which is that he was a bad president and a great ex-president. So what I'm trying to do is get beyond that.
And just to go back in my question, what I was getting at is did you know that going in about his of how much of the positives and his contributions going in that it was going to be that kind of story?
So what happened was, I'm a member of a book group in New York City. I live in New Jersey, but we were reading a book at this group called 13 Days in September by Lawrence Wright, and it's about Camp David. And Carter comes across so well in this book. It's such a virtuoso performance. And you know, then I went back and researched it all and came to the same conclusion in my chapter on Camp David. And somebody in the group knew Jimmy Carter's grandson, Jason Carter, who would run for governor of Georgia in 2014. And he arranged to bring Jimmy and Jason to our book group. And I had met Carter very briefly when I was an intern in his speechwriting office in 1978, and then kind of turned against him politically. And then I had interviewed him once when I was a columnist for Newsweek in 2000. But other than that, I really hadn't thought all that much about Jimmy Carter, and I kind of bought the conventional wisdom on him. But that evening at our book group, he was just so masterful in his early 90s in describing Camp David, and also in describing the effect of his human rights policy on Latin America, that I started to think, you know, there's more to this guy than bad president, great ex-president, that there's something here. So I started my research, and then my editor, the late Alice Mayhew at Simon & Schuster, was also Jimmy Carter's editor. He's an author. That's the way he makes his living. My editor thought it was a great idea. And then, you know, as I started to learn more in my preliminary research, I realized that there just had been so much missed about him, that he was assessed exclusively politically. And he was a political failure, but he was a substantive, even visionary success. And that's what I was trying to get at. And then when I realized, you know, how much he had done on so many different issues, both domestically and in foreign policy, and that at the end of his term, when he was getting ready to leave office, he got a report that he was prepared to act on, to take action on a new problem that scientists were just then identifying. It was sometimes called carbon pollution, or in a few cases, global warming. And he determined that he was going to take action on this challenge in a second term, but he didn't have one. So when I saw that he was, you know, that farsighted, I got hooked. He also, the complexity of the man, I think everybody understands his basic honesty and decency, but he's a very intense guy and sometimes difficult. The sort of public impression of Jimmy Carter only scratches the surface of his depths.
It seems to me that coming out of the Nixon era, and with President Ford running for re-election, his chances just seemed to be so slim of not only winning, but just getting the party's nomination. Talk a little bit about that incredible campaign and how he was able to gain traction and to be someone who really came out of nowhere, not that Plains, Georgia is nowhere, but to come out and to say, okay, I'm a force to be reckoned with.
Well, what happened was that he ran for president starting in early 1975, right after he left the governorship. He essentially ran for a full year before the Democratic primaries began. And so his opponents were all these senators who had jobs in Washington, and they represented the status quo. And Carter, who was a brilliant campaigner, just doggedly did what he had done when he got elected governor of Georgia, and just traveled incessantly, stayed at people's houses, and being, you know, unemployed really helped him, because he just decided to essentially move to Iowa and New Hampshire. And that was at a time when the Iowa caucuses were not really significant yet. Carter, in some ways, put the Iowa caucuses on the map. And he also just benefited from a fatigue in the country with the scandals of Watergate and the lying of the Vietnam War. And so his moral message, and he basically promised he would not lie, and he didn't. He fulfilled that promise. It resonated in 1976. So even though he started out at 0% in the polls, and when the pundits started to kind of rank the various candidates, almost all of them Democratic senators, and Carter wouldn't even make the list. But over time, almost by word of mouth, he started to do better and better. And then he finished second behind undecided in the Iowa caucuses. That launched him. Then he won New Hampshire. And he lost the Massachusetts primary. And it seemed as if maybe he had lost his luster. But then his big win in 1976 was in Florida. And he knocked out former Governor George Wallace. The kind of thing that I wanted to look at, Joe, was like the historic significance of certain developments that at the time were connected to the horse race. But in retrospect, that was the end of the racist wing of the Democratic Party, which had existed since the 1790s, you know, since the parties were first formed. And now, you know, you can say a lot of critical things about the Democrats, but they don't have any racists in their party. That cannot be said of the other major political party nowadays. You know, so this was a big deal because initially, you know, the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, was the more integrationist party, and the Democrats were the segregationist party. And then with Carter's defeat of Wallace, that was over. And, you know, the transition had begun more than 10 years earlier with Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, pushing through the Civil Rights Act and saying that, you know, he had lost the South for the Democrats for a long time, which turned out to be true. But Carter kind of completed that transformation. So I think he won because people were ready for a new South, and he won because he struck a chord with his moral message. And a lot of his message isn't that different than Joe Biden's this year.
Jonathan Alter is the author of the new book, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. And through this process, he became cool, which I thought was interesting. Even your cover. I mean, he was, even at the time, it's a Warhol cover. He was cool.
Yes. And it's so easy to forget that because, you know, by 1980, he wasn't cool. But I really wanted to capture with this wonderful Andy Warhol that there was a time, and actually, I think he's becoming cool again. I mean, just the reception of this book, you know, so far and just came out has been kind of overwhelming because I think that he is a is an inspiration for a beleaguered nation right now. But he felt that way in 1976, and it wasn't just Andy Warhol. He was very cool with a lot of different rock musicians and country singers. And he funded a lot of his campaign with these big concerts. And he became very personally close to a lot of these musicians, and people like Greg Allman, Bob Dylan, closer to Allman than Dylan. But, you know, there's actually a documentary out right now called Rock and Roll President.
It's about terrific. Yeah.
It's just his relationship with them. But my favorite part of that, which is not highlighted that much in a very good film, is the connection to the fundraising. So Carter would have a concert and he'd get up and he'd say, I just have three things to tell you. My name is Jimmy Carter. I'm running for president and I want your vote. And ladies and gentlemen, the Allman Brothers, you know, and all the people there, part of whose tickets were going to the ticket price was going to the Carter campaign because the promoter who was setting up these concerts was a good friend of Carter. The fans could not believe that a politician wouldn't give a speech. And they were so grateful. They went crazy. And of course, they all went out and voted for him and told their friends to vote for him. And then the other thing that happened to make him cool is that Hunter Thompson, who was the coolest journalist, gonzo journalist, had seen him. He'd gone with Ted Kennedy to Georgia in 1974 to see Kennedy give this speech at the University of Georgia Law School. And Kennedy's speech that day wasn't very good. Other times he was great, of course. And the other speakers were boring, and Thompson would go out to his car to get some wild turkey, you know, and then wander back into the luncheon. And then Carter, the governor, gets up and he delivers this blistering attack on the criminal justice system in Georgia. And the lawyers were sitting in front of him and at this lunch. And Hunter Thompson's kind of amazed, and he goes back out to his car. Instead of getting the wild turkey, he brings his tape recorder back in, and he gets this Carter speech. It's called the Law Day speech. That was one of the best speeches Carter ever gave. Mm. And the important thing is that over the next 2 years, Thompson, who has enormous credibility with young journalists and readers of Rolling Stone, pumps Carter, and he plays the tape for any journalist he can find. He calls Carter a bastard, and he means it as a compliment. You know, he says how tough he is and vouches for him all the way through, which had a big effect on making Jimmy Carter cool. And so, you know, Hunter Thompson really helped make Jimmy Carter president.
You write in this in the part of the book about, you say, the political risks of being associated with a druggy counterculture never concerned the candidate, even when he saw handmade Coke fiends for Carter signs at his rallies.
Yeah. Yeah. He was just, you know, people think of Carter sometimes as being sanctimonious, and he's obviously a very religious person. And I spend quite a bit of time in the book explaining his born again experience. And in 1968, he actually went door to door in Springfield, Massachusetts, and Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, for his Baptist faith. And he was a door to door missionary for a few weeks. And he actually came across a brothel at one point and tried to convert the madam to Christ. But he wasn't judgmental, and isn't, because he's still really with it. I mean, he's very old, 96 on October 1st, but still really with it. And one of the things that characterizes him is that he has these strong moral values and leads a strongly Christian life and teaches Sunday school, but he is not censorious about other people. And in fact, not just his audience, but a lot of his aides were, part of the counterculture. And he didn't want them breaking the law. So when it came out when he was in the White House that some White House aides had been smoking pot, he said if they did so, they should leave. But, he knew that people on his staff were having affairs, and it never fazed him. Although when his daughter-in-law found out that his son had been cheating on her, it caused a family drama that I spell out in the book, including a tearful session between his daughter-in-law and Carter in the White House. But the overall point is that Carter is a tolerant person and is modeling a kind of behavior and decency that we don't have enough of in this country.
Jonathan Alter is our guest. The name of the new book is His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. I want to read another, just a quick, one of my favorite sections of the book. I just want to quickly say, we don't have time, unfortunately, for you to tell the whole story, but I just want to direct people. There's a great story about Hunter S. Thompson on the campaign plane that is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Just an amazing story. Yeah. You write that just after the election, Hamilton Jordan had predicted that Jimmy's problem in the White House will be that he's going to try to do everything at once. Sure enough, despite Furbish nearly round-the-clock work early on, energy wasn't the clear priority of his first year, but just one of dozens of initiatives. Carter introduced so many bills that Burt Lance thought, quote, it looked more like a smorgasbord than an agenda. That says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think that contributed to some of his problems because he didn't sequence his bills in a politically skillful way. And some of his inexperience, which was very refreshing in a lot of ways, and he was an outsider, hampered him in Washington. But a lot of it was just that the Georgia Mafia, as they called it, you know, Hamilton Jordan and Jody Powell and the others around him from Georgia, became kind of insular, and they didn't mix well with the Georgetown establishment. And they had good reason to resent some of that establishment because there's a lot of anti-Southern bias. And the press corps, the post-Watergate press corps that had helped make him president, turned on him with a vengeance. As Jody Powell said, you know, he didn't only, not only did he not get a honeymoon, he didn't even get a one-night stand with the press. And but throughout, he was doing things that were important but politically inconvenient for Carter. And when he had a choice between doing what he thought was right and doing what he thought was political, in almost every case, there were a couple of exceptions, but in almost every case, he did what he thought was right. And in the kind of long reach of history, most of the time he was right, especially on energy and the environment and things that relate to the long-term interests of the country, but on foreign policy as well.
You write about the impact. Another fascinating thing that I really was interested in the book that I didn't know much about was the relationship with Ted Kennedy. I think you say at just one point that the two men simply didn't like each other. And what impact did Senator Kennedy, Teddy Kennedy, have on Carter when it came to re-election?
Well, first, there was this kind of tragic clash between the two. Politics is so personal, you know, so much of history turns on these personal relationships. And there was enough blame to go around, but they couldn't get together on a health care plan. Kennedy held out for a more aggressive plan, not single payer, not Medicare for all, interestingly. He thought that was politically impossible. But he wanted a more expansive plan. Carter kind of stalled too long before introducing his pretty good plan, and they didn't see eye to eye on that. So that then set the stage for Kennedy challenging Carter for the nomination, which in retrospect is kind of mind-blowing. And I am critical of myself because after being a Carter intern in 1978, in 1980, when I was just out of college, I actually volunteered for a few weeks for Kennedy. And in retrospect, I'm thinking, what was I thinking? You know, we had a perfectly good Democratic president. He might not have been ready for Mount Rushmore, but he was a good president. And he just wasn't, by that time, he wasn't cool. And Kennedy was Camelot and cool, and let's restore the, you know, the Kennedy family tradition and put him in the White House. And even though Kennedy was a pretty bad candidate, he did a lot of damage to Carter, and he divided the Democratic Party. And then at the Democratic Convention in New York in the summer of 1980, you know, when Carter finally won the nomination, Kennedy came up on the podium, and he wouldn't give him the money shot where they extend their hands above to, you know, appear on the cover of news magazines and for television. Kennedy wouldn't do that. And I asked Carter what he was thinking when Kennedy came on stage, and Carter said that he was drunk. I don't know that Kennedy was drunk, and that might just be Carter's animus at that point. But it was ugly. And in retrospect, it helped pave the way for Reagan. Democrats don't come together the way Republicans do a lot of the time. They are right now for Joe Biden. And, you know, this year is a little, there's such terror about Trump that that forced them together. But you can expect that if Biden wins next year, the Democratic Party is not going to be nearly as unified. And I think, you know, we've been sort of traumatized a little bit by that 1980 experience for older Democratic Party operatives. They realize how damaging that schism in the party turned out to be for the, not just the Democratic Party, but for the country.
There's a photo that you include in the book of five presidents, George W. Bush, along with Barack Obama, George H.W. Bush, and President Clinton, and they're grouped together, and then just maybe a foot apart is Jimmy Carter. And you talk about how his comments about his successors ensured that he would remain outside their club. Talk a little bit about his time and what that has meant as a former president, how he not only works with his predecessors, but also the independence that he has shown in his post-presidency.
Well, you know, I entitle one chapter Freelance Secretary of State. And if you're president, you don't really want a freelance Secretary of State, a former president who's out there now. You know, he technically would get permission before he would go places, but he was very high maintenance for his successors. And there's a lot of conflict that he had with them. And his relationship with Bill Clinton was particularly fraught. I interviewed George H.W. Bush not long before he died. And I also interviewed Barack Obama. But Bill Clinton, they're still, even though he gave Carter the Presidential Medal of Freedom at one point, you know, there are just still some hard feelings there. And there are great stories that we don't have time for, but they're in the book about these clashes between Carter and his successors. He got along well with Gerald Ford after he beat him, and they kind of set the tone for a good relationship between former presidents, but not so well with Clinton. And he first got along with George H.W. Bush, then he didn't. Of course, he didn't get along with Reagan at all. It's a whole other story. Obama, it's a little complicated. Obama finally gave me an interview after my deadline passed on the print book, but he's it's reflected in the audio book available through Audible. And Obama, I think, has come to appreciate Carter, even though he didn't call on him much when he was president, which hurt Carter personally.
Again, the name of the book is His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.